What did you say to me, Mr. Capehart? What did you just say?
Wait, you're going to make me repeat it?
Yes. What did you just say to me?
I said, you're not going to put on a shirt collar for me.
You just told me I should dress more appropriate to be with you in your presence?
No, just, I mean, you know, I went and put on a shirt. I put a sweater on to be decent. And you show up like you just came from the treadmill. I'm just going to keep watching cat videos.
Jump through all kinds of hoops. Look pretty. They are sitting there in a sweater in the dead of summer. Is this better? It's a button down. So let me do the button.
Yo, folks, my guest today is a dear buddy of mine. I have a lot of fun with Jonathan Capehart. He makes me laugh, and I just have a real good vibe every time we're together. He is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, co-host of The Weekend on MSNBC, and associate editor at The Washington Post, where he is also an opinion writer, and you can and should read his work there. He's also an analyst on the PBS NewsHour. His editorial campaign in 1999 to save the Apollo Theater earned the board the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing. He is a phenomenal individual who has an incredible journey and story that he tells in his new book, his new memoir, Yet Here I Am, Lessons from a Black Man's Search for Home. It is out now. We get into it. We have some fun. And a lot of little lessons in there, particularly one with what you should do with your porn. Tune in, folks, coming up right after this. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. Yes, I'm talking to this guy. He literally is like a brother to me. He's like the brother I didn't have growing up. He's so much fun. We get along. We cuss and fight and love and hate together like brothers do, right? Jonathan Capehart, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thanks, Michael. It's good to be back. You forgot I've done this before.
I know you have. I know, but yeah. I'm always, every time's like the first time. That's what they tell me. Every time should be like the first time.
Oh, okay.
You want that shit to work? It better be, because next thing you know, somebody else will be having a first time.
What was Michael, that? We haven't even started and we're off the rails.
I know. This is why Jonathan Capehart and Michael Steele are trouble. Yet here I am. Here we are. I am so excited for this book and for you, because I know and have gotten the opportunity over the years to glean a little bit of that journey, your time in New York, the decisions you made to move from one job to the next, moving to Washington. You capture all of that, and it's funny. It's insightful. It is a journey that obviously it took a moment for you to sort of decide you wanted to make publicly. You're always, you know, but it's one thing to talk about it and to put it on the street, as they say, and to give context to your life in a way that most people don't normally get or see. How did that feel for you to write the book?
Well, first, thank you, Michael, for having me on to talk about the book. You have to go to the beginning in terms of who were my role models when it came time to start thinking about writing this book. And there are two, and they're separated by 20 years, and then two completely different people. Mm-hmm. Hay Graham, Catherine Graham, the legendary publisher of the Washington Post. Her autobiography, personal. Oh my God, I'm now forgetting the name of her book. I've said it so many times.
Yeah, age is a bitch. Don't fret
so
it.
Many understand. Times it's like a personal history.
Personal history.
Personal history. And when I read that book 25 years ago, I was struck by the fact that here's this woman, most powerful woman in journalism, one of the most powerful women in the country. And she was raw, honest about her candid introspective, about her fraught relationship with her mother, about her insecurities running the paper, the Washington Post, certainly after the death of her husband, not knowing whether she was doing the right thing. She wrote all about what was happening during Watergate. And I thought, wow, if this powerful person, this powerful woman can be this honest, you know, this is the kind of biography and autobiography I want to read. 20 years later, Charles Blow and his memoir, Fire Shut Up in My Bones, same thing. Raw, honest, introspective. And here you have two completely different people, one Black, one white, one woman, one man, one gay, one not, and both being as raw and honest and open about their lives. And I thought, if ever I got the chance to write a book, I must be that open, that raw, that honest for the reader, because that's what I loved about their books and what I thought made their books so powerful. And right. I thought I would want the same for me. And then one other thing, a really good friend of mine, Richie Jackson, wrote a book, Gay Like Me, A Letter from a Father to His Son. And this is my friend, Richie Jackson, who wrote a letter to his out gay son about what it's like to be an out gay man and walking him through what it was like in the 80s and the 90s in New York City and how to be his full self. And when we were talking, as I was writing my book, he said to me, Jonathan, put yourself on every page. Just remember to do that. And so between Katharine Graham, Charles Blow, and Richie Jackson, they were sort of like the angels, one over here, right. One over here, and one up here, guiding me through. And that's what made it easy for me to write some really hard things.
Right. Well, it didn't hurt to be at a villa in Italy while you were writing it, but that's a whole nother conversation.
No, it didn't.
When you read the book, folks, you'll appreciate that reference, but also the fact that Jonathan speaks very, very good Italian, and that was really kind of that. You and I are alike in the sense that Italy is a muse in a way that because there's such a crossroads of art and fashion and culture and all kinds of things that is oftentimes overlooked or underappreciated. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the modern times when you're looking, you know, places like New York and things like that, where you're at Met Gala and all this other stuff. And I kid Jonathan about his escapades in Europe, particularly in Italy. Escapades. Yes, he has escapades, people.
Escapades.
He has escapades, trust me, you know. But you really do go through that journey. One of the first questions I wanted to ask you was, so what was it like, you know, attending, you know, the University of Yves Saint Laurent and the University of Pierre Cardin? I mean, because it is so Jonathan.
You want me to tell this story
because it's so funny. It is such a rich moment.
It was a moment that was seared into my soul so much so that I have not forgotten it from the moment it happened. So I was brand new to the New York Daily News editorial board. So I was about 25, 26 years old. And I had pitched the idea of interviewing Reverend Jackson about something related to New York City schools and guns. Reverend Jackson said yes to the interview. So we set up a time and he said, well, my schedule's really busy. I'm coming through New York. Why don't we do it at LaGuardia? And so I was like, great. I'm meeting Reverend Jackson. So I put on my best suit. And it was this brand new suit that I bought. It was a Christian Dior, double-breasted, with a chalk stripe.
Only way Jonathan Capehart's going to attire himself, trust me.
You know, I was just like, I'm about to meet history, so I need to look right. So I get dressed. I'm so nervous that I'm going to miss him that I get to LaGuardia an hour early. And for my time at the Today Show, I knew there were conference rooms at the Eastern shuttle or Delta shuttle, whatever it was, you know, in 93. And so I get there, I get us a room, and now I'm waiting at the gate. Flight lands, there's nobody. And then I realize, wait, folks can deplane out the back. Let me go and look. And that's when I saw him walking across the tarmac to baggage. So I ran to baggage, and who's with him but the Reverend Al Sharpton.
Mm-hmm.
And so Reverend Al Sharpton, I was like, oh man, I don't want to, this guy, this is when Reverend Al and I, this is my first time meeting him. So we get up to the conference room, we sit down, and Reverend Sharpton says, this is what I heard. And I said, excuse me? And he said, what kind of, this is what it sounds like. And I'm trying to decipher. So I say, I think in my head, he's asking me, what kind of suit is that? So I said, oh, this is my first suit that I bought since graduation. It's a,
Lord
Christian,
have mercy.
It's a Christian Dior, double-breasted, da-da-da-da-da, did the whole thing. And then that's when I look up and I see him laughing. And he just looks at me and says in the clearest articulated English, I asked you, what college did you go to? And I just wanted to self-immolate. I died. I just, you know, if I could just go into the void or Homer Simpson my way out of that room into the hedges. And I just looked and I said, oh, I went to Carleton College. And then he and Reverend Jackson sort of ping pong.
Yeah.
I went to the College of Pierre Cardin. Well, I went to the College of Yves Saint Laurent. And I was just like, ha ha, very funny. Let's get started. I've never forgotten that. I was embarrassed.
But it just tells you, you know, the framing of that is important on a number of levels, because it says a lot about you as a young man trying to figure out the spaces and get it right, and how sort of the established order of things comes across. I mean, in other words, it just wasn't very clear what he said. I mean, you know, if the man was speaking the King's English in a way you understood it at the time, you would have answered the question.
Right.
But it is so funny, though, because what's interesting about that moment is the arc it would later have with the Apollo Theater and your encounters with Reverend Sharpton,
mm-hmm.
Which ultimately the writing that you did about the Apollo and that period in New York got you the Pulitzer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that arc is an important one in how I read through the book. Those things that took place at a certain time would then come back in another time, in a different way, in a different shape, a different form. But there would be some connection to you, I mean, for you in terms of your path, your growth, and the impact that it would have on you, and you would ultimately have on the business you chose. Mm-hmm. What was that part of the journey like when you were having that second moment with Al Sharpton, where he pulls you aside and says he wants to talk to you about something you've written or about him and the failure of leadership, right? To deal with the problem. Did you remember that moment you just talked about, or had that just faded away into something else?
Oh, no. That was an indelible moment. I mean, that moment just was seared into my soul. And that began to, that initially defined my relationship with Sharpton. We were like this for years. He hated the editorial and column I ran as a result of that meeting. And he, you know, I remember my editor calling me into his office because Reverend Sharpton was on the phone and he had him on speaker. And all you could hear was, I told Capers. He wouldn't even pronounce my name correctly. He was right. Capers. So fast forward. So then after that, we met up again. We were both on Geraldo Rivera Live when he had a show on CNBC, The Night of the Million Man March. And it was that interview again. We were like this, and he again mispronounced my name, much to the consternation of my mother. My mother then told me, tell Al Sharpton to pronounce your name correctly. Years later, when Rev and I became friendly, this is an aside, I told him what my mother said, and he laughed and he said, well, you know, that's a tactic. By mispronouncing your name, I belittle you to the audience. And so you, by the time you get to speak, you have been belittled in their eyes because—
Very Trumpian. Yeah. Very Trumpian.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I was like, oh.
Early Trump.
If you ever watched Rev's show on MSNBC and I'm on the show, you notice he says my name very clearly because he doesn't want my mom mad at him. But to get back, so when we're doing the Apollo, again, we are still like this. So that first initial thing was 93. We're now at 1998. Right. And so we're doing the Apollo Theater editorials. He's already held a community forum where they bashed the hell out of the New York Daily News, saying things like it's the white media establishment coming after us in Harlem, which I knew was going to be, you know, part of the tactic to defend the leadership of the Apollo. And we ran a few of the editorials. I went on New York one. And then I get a phone call from Reverend Sharpton. They said, we need to meet. And I said, you mean we, the editorial board, or we meaning you and me? And he said, no, just the two of us. I said, great. I meet him at what was then the Stage Deli on 7th Avenue.
Right.
And he comes in and, you know, we get right down to it. And he asks me, why are you doing this? And he said, because there's a rumor that you're doing this at the behest of Governor George Pataki, who was the Republican governor at the time, to, for lack of a better description, dirty up then Congressman Charlie Rangel, because he was on his way to becoming, if the Democrats retook the majority, chair of the very powerful House Ways and Means Committee. And I looked at Reverend Sharpton, and I said, Reverend Sharpton, that's not true. This has nothing to do with the governor. This has nothing to do with any battle that they might be having. This has everything to do with saving the Apollo. And I walked him through why we were doing it, our tour, what we saw. And I said, Reb, you've been to the theater. You know it's a dump. We're trying to save the theater. And we were just, you know, Stage Deli at the time was just above Times Square, blocks from Times Square. And that was when The Lion King had opened up on Broadway and, you know, was part of the revitalized Broadway. And I said, Rev, why shouldn't the Apollo Theater be as successful as all these revamped theaters down on Broadway? The Lion King is making money hand over fist. Meanwhile, the Apollo Theater is sitting dark 5 to 6 nights a week. Where's the why isn't the chairman, he eventually became chairman, but why shouldn't Charlie Rangel, dean of the congressional delegation, best friends with still President Clinton at the time, why couldn't he get an earmark? Why couldn't he use his power to help the theater? Right. And I just want to use this opportunity right now because the late, great Charlie Rangel, Chairman Rangel, passed away yesterday on the 26th of May. And, you know, he was another person who, you know, we battled over the Apollo Theater. We battled so much that when I went to the state dinner for the South African president and took my mother as my date.
Right.
He and I got into it in the tent on the South Lawn. I don't write about this in the book, but we got into it on the South Lawn, and I had my mother on my side, and he had his wife, Alma, on the other side, and she jumped in and said, you know, now, this is not the place. But that began the slow repair of the relationship to the point when I moved to Washington, I talked to the congressman many times about many things when I got to the Washington Post. And so back to the story with Reb, I tell him the whole thing and he looked at me and he said, I believe you. And then said, you know, listen, anytime you want to find out what's going on, call me. And if I know something, I will tell you, and I won't say anything about this again. And Rev kept his word. He never said anything about the Apollo Theater publicly again. And that began our relationship, very good relationship that's now more than 25 years old.
So you wrote in that section of the book something that I in my political life, particularly as a young Black conservative Republican working in the District of Columbia where I grew up, or in the state of Maryland where I'd become an elected official. You wrote a passage that I thought really summed up one of the biggest problems. And really to me, and I don't want to project anything onto the relationship or certainly anything onto Rev, because Rev and I have, you know, like you, started out at political polar opposites. And, you know, we work together very well now and love the Rev. But you wrote, quote, I came to learn how that custom of respect and deference, which is something that is very prominent in the Black community, that you have respect and deference for your elders, right? And so therefore you give them a large swath of land from which to operate, large space. You went on, could serve as a cloak against accountability, allowing people to say or do nothing even when things are wrong. And that is so profoundly true, that the individuals in leadership at that time who had responsibility for that theater at that time and for the conditions in Harlem at that time, who represented those districts and those communities at that time, seemingly were okay with the status quo. And so what you did by leveling up the conversation and exposing what was happening or not happening and writing about that and articulating that struck a nerve. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that is what is profoundly important. For you in particular, given your journey, this idea of holding people accountable for what they do, telling the story and the untold stories that people should know, would really kind of, I think, at least my sense in reading from there on, Jonathan, it really kind of defined how you would continue to do your work. You know, making the move to Bloomberg after that was a big deal, right? Because you didn't think you dude, this is finance. What the hell I know about finance? I'm not writing about finance, right?
Right.
But you found a voice there. You found that even in that space, in a space that was at least perceptually far afield from where you were and what you were doing, you could land and tell a story.
Right. Well, there are two pieces to this. So in terms of holding folks accountable, I mean, in some ways, you could say I was and remain very naive. I actually think that people in positions of leadership should be held accountable, especially people in positions of public trust.
Right.
And, you know, understanding and realizing that on the one hand, I understand why people will rally around someone who they feel is under attack unfairly by some outside community, because that's what they always do. But then if, you know, here I am, a Black journalist, and I see something happening that is to the detriment of a Black institution, well, wait, what? You want me to stay silent because the chair of the board is the dean of the congressional delegation and is a representative of Harlem, and anything bad would reflect poorly, not just on him, but on the community, and therefore we must protect him. I'm sorry, no.
Right.
No, that's just not how this works or how this should work. And so, you know, I took a lot of heat from people who, you know, on the one hand, growing up, I was too Black, and now suddenly I'm not Black enough.
Right.
Because I have the temerity to write stuff trying to hold elected officials accountable. But, you know, naive or not, I had the presence of mind to say to my editor, we should hold publication of these editorials because you're planning on running them when I'm out of town. And I know the moment these hit, they're going to say the white Daily News is coming for, you know, the black leadership of Harlem.
Right,
and I wanted to be in a position that the editorials run, and then I go on New York One as the visual, like, nope, this has nothing to do with the way they're casting it. It has everything to do with protecting a Harlem landmark. And I'm really happy, you know, the Apollo Theater is thriving now. Yeah. It is thriving with fantastic leadership, a fantastic board. So I'm happy we did it. The second piece of what you were saying about me going to Bloomberg and, you know, this financial news behemoth and being like, what? You're offering me a job. That gets to one of the big lessons in my book, which is when someone asks you what you want, tell them.
Yeah.
You know, we win the Pulitzer. The myth is, well, your phone rings off the hook, people offering you jobs, and that wasn't the case. And so
was that the case for everybody or just some people?
Well, at least for those of us on the board, none of our phones rang.
Interesting.
In fact, you know what's really interesting? Our phones rang all the time when we were reporting and doing stuff. Our phones, and particularly mine, basically stopped ringing. People stopped calling. And I heard from a lot of friends like, oh, well, we didn't want to bother you. I was like, wait, what? Pick up the phone. And so, and it's been like that. Like, my phone hasn't rung off the hook since 1999. Like,
wow.
That. So, but back to the lesson story. So a friend said, you should go talk to Bloomberg News. And I've been putting him off for months saying, it's financial news. I don't do that. I write about politics. And no, really, you should go. So I make the appointment, an informational interview. And I figured, why the hell not? I'm not going to work there. This is just, it doesn't hurt to talk to someone. That's another lesson. Talk to anybody who wants to talk to you. So everything that could go wrong did go wrong. My two appropriate interview suits were in the cleaners. So guess what suit I had to wear? The Jesse Jackson Al Sharpton suit. Double breasted, you don't wear double breasted suit, pinstripe suits to an interview. And I only had loafers to wear. You should be wearing lace ups. And it was raining.
Folks, I can't tell you the tutorial lessons I get from Jonathan Capehart. I'm just saying.
Continue. So it's a downpour, can't get a cab, have to walk in the rain three blocks, get on a hot subway, glasses all fogged up. I am pissed the hell off. I get out at 53rd and Park and have to walk to 60th and Park, 499 Park Avenue, in the rain. By this point, I am soaked, basically from the thighs down. Finally get upstairs. Oh, and I used a new technology called the cell phone to let them know I would be late. So I finally get up on the floor. I am, if anyone's watched me on television, you know, I can't hide anything with this. So I can only imagine like the contortions of rage on my face when I got off the elevator. I mean, I am not kidding. The water from the cuffs in my suit pants were dripping into my shoes. When I walked, all you heard was squish, 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 squish. So there I am, and there's the head of Bloomberg News standing there in his bow tie, Matthew Winkler. And I said, I am so sorry, I am late. You know, thank you for the meeting. He gives me a tour around, tells me everything about Bloomberg. And then we go to a conference room and he says, so what do you think? And I said, about what? And he said, about coming to work here. And I looked at him and I said, oh no, 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 no. I don't want to work here. This is financial news. I don't do that. And so he got, from my vantage point, mad. And since I'm looking at the camera, this is what he did. Well, what do you want to do? And so I was like, bet. I got a job. I love where I work. I don't want to work here anyway. I've got nothing to lose. So I looked him dead in the eye and I said, well, I want to write a column once a week and go on television and talk about it like I do right now. And then I sat back in the chair, folded my arms and stared him dead in the eye. And then he broke the staring contest and he said, well, why can't you do that here? And then proceeded to give me the same tour, but this time adding in the information that they had just started an opinion section on the Bloomberg terminal. They were hiring people and that I would be perfect. I freaked out. I said, oh, look at the time. I have got to get to my Ed Board meeting downtown.
You ran out of the meeting?
I ran out.
He just offered you a job.
Right. Anyone who's watching this right now, I know, Michael, there are people watching right now who have been in that situation where someone asked them what they wanted and they told them. And then the next thing comes in, which is self-sabotage. They're like, oh my God, someone's actually going to give me what I want. And so I ran out of there. We kept in touch. Long story short, by the end of that week, I had become the national affairs columnist for Bloomberg News and had tripled my salary.
And you had a problem with that.
Well, remember, he only offered me a job. I ran out of there not knowing the salary, what the title was, or anything.
He offered you a job at Bloomberg, which at the time, with Michael Bloomberg doing what Michael Bloomberg was doing.
Well, about to do.
Well,
remember,
about
this
to.
This is in 2000.
Right.
This is
right.
In 2000. And so I ran out of there, freaked out. But remember, by the end of the week, I said yes.
Right. So what made you say yes?
It's a phenomenal job. Someone says to you,
why didn't you see that in the moment?
Because I didn't have the details. Are you listening to me? Through multiple conversations, he first tells me, I come up with the title, National Affairs Columnist, Bloomberg News. Sounded great. Then he said, you can go anywhere in the country and report, just like you do right now.
But did he tell you all of that in the first meeting?
No.
So in the first meeting, the only thing he said to you was, how do you like this?
Correct.
And then you took from that what?
Remember, I then said, this is financial news. I don't want to do that. He asked me what I wanted to do. I told him. He said, why can't you do that here? And then basically said, I've got an opinion section. You'd be great. That's when I freaked out. It's like, I have to go. It was in subsequent phone calls in the days later, like two over, you know, later that day and then the next day.
Well, that's what I want to pull the curtain back on a little bit. So in that moment, when he says, you can do that here.
Right.
I've got a plan and you're part of it. You can do that here. Your response was fight or flight.
It was flight. Flight. Out.
And I want to know why in that moment. Tell me because he didn't tell you anything. You didn't let him.
No. Because there are going to be people who are going to watch this and they will know exactly what I'm talking about.
See, this is totally foreign to me. So that's why I'm trying to understand it, because I'm not that person.
Most people, one, are never asked what they want. Two, never say what they want when asked for fear of someone telling them that they can't do it. And then three, when those first two things are met, and someone says here, folks don't quite know how to handle it. And so a lot of people will self-sabotage. And so it's a matter of at what point do you get over the self-sabotage? So I self-sabotaged myself by getting the hell out of the room.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, no. Wow, look at the time, I've got to go. But I knew, I had to have known deep down, he was going to call me because he said, well, let's talk later today. Because I said, oh, I have to go because I have to get to a meeting. I didn't shut it completely down.
Right.
So
right.
Later that day, and over the next couple days, more details were filled in. Here's the possible title. Here's what specifically I would want you to do. And then finally I was like, well, how much are you going to pay me? He right. wouldn't do it over the phone.
Right.
He wouldn't do it over email. He would only do it over the phone. And that was when he said, here's your base salary. Plus at Bloomberg, we have profit sharing. And so here's what your minimum bonus would be.
And you lay all of that out in the book. But what I wanted folks to sort of get to with you, because I thought that was a very interesting moment we started the conversation about the journey, and that was a very interesting moment in the journey where you effectively were taking yourself out of the game, right? You were like, no. But I'm curious as to what was it about that in that moment that instead of leaning in, you flew away from it.
I think I've explained this a couple times. Remember,
I know some people do that, but I'm talking about for you and your job. You just won a Pulitzer,
right?
All right, so you're not a guy. I mean, you won a Pulitzer for heaven's sakes,
right?
It's not like you they picked up a salami sandwich and handed it to you on a trophy.
But still, remember, it wasn't in this one meeting where he said, come work here. I want you to write once a week, and here's what your salary would be. Now, if he had done all of that in that moment before I ran out of the room, I would have been like, I'm not going to give you an answer now. Let me think about this. Instead, what happened was I was asked what I wanted. I told him. He then said, here you go. And it was just this jolt of like, wait, what? Whoa. He's saying, let's do this. And all I can say is my gut reaction was to get the hell out of the room at that moment. But
so did you have an expectation that you would get back, that he would, you? So you say you thought he would follow back up. What would have happened if he didn't?
He said, let's keep, I know you have to go, let's keep
talking. What would happen if he didn't? Let's say he didn't. Well, let's say after the meeting, he had a revelation like you did. And he went, you know what? He's not clearly not interested. I'm not going to waste my time.
But that didn't happen. And he did not give me any indication that there would be a loss of interest.
You gave him an indication that you weren't interested.
Right, I did, but then he presented me with an incredible option. And again, the conversation kept going. Also, understand, remember, I went into that meeting not wanting to work there, perfectly happy with the job I had. And so to my mind, I was in a really good position. I was not desperate for a new job. I was not desperate for anything. I was just having a conversation. And what ended up happening was that I ended up getting a brand new job, a fantastic job, which didn't reveal itself until we kept talking over the next few days.
That's it. All right, well, folks, y'all gonna have to read that portion of the book so you can see the point I was trying to make with Jonathan, because, you know, it was very intriguing. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back with the inimitable Jonathan Capehart, or Capers, as Reverend Sharpton, we're going to find out why it's so important to hide your porn well. We'll be right back right after this. everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele Podcast. We are with my good buddy, the one and only Pulitzer Prize winning Jonathan Capehart, who has a new book out, which I highly recommend. It is a, it will be for you a very good summer read. Trust me on this one. Yet Here I Am, Lessons from a Black Man's Search for Home. We've been having a little fun with Jonathan's journey from Jersey to New York to Washington. Although he considers himself a New Yorker, he's really a Jersey boy. He can't help it. His Jersey does come out every once in a while, as it did in chapter 8 of the book, where you tell the story of why it's important to hide your porn very well. Mr. Capehart, could you explain to us exactly why that's important and how you found yourself in that situation?
So, children, this is back in the day when such materials were in magazine form. And so, you know, you would find ways of acquiring these materials.
You would make subtle purchases.
Several purchases, and then you would have to hide them as a means of maintaining your privacy. And when you are a closeted, somewhat closeted gay kid, you really want to hide this stuff because you're coming out as a journey and you've got to do it at your own pace and your own time. And so I was not ready to come out to my mother and then stepfather when my mother called me, because I was working at Carleton College after I graduated. I was assistant to the president. My mother called me and said, I think this marriage is on its last leg. I'm probably going to leave by the end of the week. And I said, oh, okay. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, oh my God, I have a stash of magazines in the eaves, and my room was on the top of the house, and so the eaves are right there, easy access. So I called my junior college roommate, Ricardo, who lived in Teaneck, and I was like, Ricardo, I have a mission for you. You have to go get my porn stash. So he said, I'm on it.
A sentence that many, many friends have heard, I'm sure.
Yeah. The number of people who have come up to me and said, I have a similar story. So Ricardo goes, and we had an appointed time and everything. I told my mom Ricardo was coming. He had to get something, you know, and I didn't go into any details and she didn't ask. So I told him to call me the moment, you know, the mission was completed. So I come back from dinner, hit the answering machine, and all I hear is this. Hey, Jonathan, it's Ricardo. I'm back. Call me when you get this. And I was like, uh-oh. Now, Ricardo is exuberant and everything, and this was real subdued. So I call him back, and he says, hello. And I said, Ricardo, hey, what's going on? He said, has your mother called you yet? And I said, oh, God, no, why? And then he proceeds to unspool this story and how he got there. They were both there. My mom followed him up and chitty chatty chatty. Do you need help? Oh, no, Jonathan told me exactly where. And so he, you know, follows instructions. He gets the box. I told him to bring tape because the box was brittle. And he said he got tape and he wrapped it up and he got it out. And he got downstairs. He had to go down 3 flights of stairs. And so, you know, my mom is walking in front of him and she's chattering away. And as he's getting to the bottom of the stairs, he missed the last step. And he tripped. And the box flew out of his hand and hit the ground.
Of course it
and
did.
Splattered all over the floor.
All over the floor.
It was
right at your mama's feet.
Tsunami of porn.
tsunami of porn.
I as he told the story, I'm sitting in my darkened living room in Northfield, Minnesota, and all I could scream into the phone was, what? What? Oh my God. What? And my life flashed before my eyes. Just flashed before my eyes. And as I'm here in my own sort of interior hell, I start coming back to consciousness because I hear this laughing on the other end of the phone. And it is Ricardo laughing his butt off because he got over on me the biggest practical joke. He's laughing and he said, everything is fine. The box is fine. But that's how the chapter opens, and that begins the story of my coming out to my mother then years later. But I loved writing that chapter. That chapter was one of the original chapters I wrote back in 2017, or a vignette, and right. It has remained, it's pretty much the same as it was written 8 years ago.
What was that process like for you, coming out as a young Black man in a very public space like journalism? You didn't have a job necessarily where, because you wanted to do TV, you wanted to be on TV as well. So right. it wasn't like, you know, you could write anonymously, you know, per se. What was that process for you?
Well, when I finally did come out to my mother, I was working at WNYC as assistant to the president. That was when it was owned by the city of New York. The first thing my mother said to me after I came out to her was, don't tell anybody. And folks have to remember, in early 1990s America, in yeah. any profession, you just coming out as LGBTQ, we didn't even have the Q back then, or the I or the A or the plus.
Yeah, it was just gay and lesbian.
It was right. just gay and lesbian, but you could not be out. You could lose your job, you still can. But the society just was not there right. then the way it is now. And I said to my mom, you know, look, I can't hide. I've got a giant neon sign over my head that just screams gay. So if anybody asks me, I'm not going to lie, but I'm also not going to lead with it. And so I have always been of the mindset that people can see it, and I'm not going to lie about it. And so when I got to the New York Daily News as an editorial writer, we were writing a lot of editorials about unsafe sex happening in gay movie theaters. Again, this is the early 90s, gay bathhouses right. and stuff. And so, you know, I was writing them. And then I remember my editor coming to me as we were editing a piece, and he had all these questions. You know, why don't the younger gays listen to the older gays? Why don't they listen to their experiences and stuff like that? And I had all the answers, but I couldn't answer him unless I came out. And so I said to him, with him sitting right next to me at my desk, I said to him, Arthur, you know I'm gay, right? And he didn't even look at me. He was slumped in the chair like this. And he goes, did I know for a fact? No. Did I suspect? Yes. And I laughed, and then I proceeded to answer his questions. And that, you know, was a very liberating moment, because that's when I understood that my being an out gay person on the editorial board gave the editorial board an insight into a community and a voice from the community at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And someone who could legitimize the opinions that were written. Now, the editorials that we wrote and the opinion piece I wrote, you know, getting undressed, going undercover, where I went undercover at this gay bathhouse. I mean, people were angry. Lots of people in the gay community were
angry. And again, why they thought you were spying on them?
Spying on them. They thought I was, you know, airing the community's dirty laundry out there. A lot of the things that were being said about me in the Black community as a result of the Apollo Theater stuff were being said about me in the gay community. Right. They're all calling me a neocon and a self-hating gay and all of this stuff. But interesting thing that I learned, when I went out to events, particularly gay events, people started coming up to me. They were always very quiet. They always sidle up, introduce themselves, and then they would lower their voice and they would say, I love your writing on this. Keep it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept happening. And that's when I understood my role in the job that I had and in the job that I have is to be the voice of those folks who don't have the platform, don't have the courage, too afraid to say the things that I'm actually saying. Mm-hmm. Or is the way like, I'm the one in the foxhole who pokes his head up and takes all the shots because of what I'm saying. But there are all these people behind me who are supporting what I'm doing and what I'm saying because they can't or they won't say the things that I'm saying.
I was going to say that raises a very interesting question because that I wanted to get to, and you just walked right into it. And that is, what is it like to write anonymously as a member of an editorial board? So when you see it in the Post or the Daily News or wherever you're writing, your name isn't there.
Right.
But then as opposed to writing under your own name as a columnist, which you're doing now, do you approach it differently?
Yes.
Do people respond differently? How does that like?
So when you're writing for an editorial board anonymously, you are writing for the institution. You are writing on behalf of the New York Daily News in that case, or on behalf of the Washington Post. You are, because you are doing the reporting and you are doing the writing, you are the one with the expertise. You are the one, you are given some deference because you've done the reporting. And the conversations around the table on any given topic, the editorial is a consensus document. Mm-hmm. And so it must reflect the viewpoints that are around the table. And then you file the editorial and people get to read it. They can nitpick, they can do all sorts of things. And then it goes into the paper, or as the case now, it goes online.
Goes online or whatever.
And so you have to take yourself out of it, even though it's primarily, it could be your opinion, but it's your opinion based on your reporting on behalf of the editorial board, on behalf of the institution, which is completely different than writing under your own name, where you're doing the same reporting, but now you get to say, like, this is what I think. And there are words and phrases and viewpoints that you could use under your name that you wouldn't if you're writing for the institution. And so that is the difference. And obviously it's much easier I'll speak for myself, easier and more fun to write under your own name
because
it's you. And I know I write, I can defend every word, every paragraph, every thought in the piece when it's a column written by me.
So you served on editorial boards for a good long time. For such a young guy,
25 years.
So, a significant portion of your professional life in that space. So talk about that moment at the Washington Post where you decided to resign. You removed yourself from the Washington Post editorial board. I know you and I talked about it personally. I won't share our personal conversation on that here. But that was a pretty powerful moment for you. It was a principled moment for you, particularly given your longevity and work as an editorial board member. What was that like for you? What was hard about it? What was easy about it?
It was difficult because, as the only African American on the editorial board, having a discussion about, the ability of Black people to vote in Georgia and expressing objection about a proposed editorial, I made my objections. The editorial didn't run, I, you know, sent a note to everyone. I then turned it into a column. I mean, I really want people to, people pick up the book, do not jump ahead to that chapter and read that chapter, because you need to read the pages leading up in order for you to truly understand why I had to, as Steele said, take this principled stand. And so it all boils down to, you cannot have me, and this is me speaking for myself, me, I, as the lone African-American on the Ed board, who it said, you know, writing about national politics and societal issues, black stuff and gay stuff, as I called it, and then ignore me as the lone African-American on the board to say, you, it's not fair to criticize the president for calling the new Georgia laws Jim Crow 2.0. Because just because people show up to vote in huge numbers and they jump through all those hoops doesn't mean that the law still isn't an ass. It just means that people jump through all the hoops in order to stand in line to vote. But an editorial ran that included a line, criticize later on during the, when the runoff happened, criticizing the president, putting in the line that I and other people objected to during a meeting. And so it was in that moment when I decided I can't sit around that table anymore. I mean, you cannot use me as I, and I don't, can't remember, I might have edited this line out or it might still be there. I can't remember, but I'd gotten tired of being black dropped. For some of the editorials. And again, remember, when you're on an editorial board, while you are not the voice, the lone voice of the community at the table, you are a voice from the community at that table, but no one else is there. And so whatever community you belong to, you know, women, Catholics, Jews, LGBTQ, gun owner, you people come to the table as their whole selves, or at least they should at those tables, because that's why we're there. It, some of these things that are discussed around the table aren't just policy.
Right.
They are people's lived experience, and that's what gives editorials their power, when they come from a knowing place. Not from a white paper that was written about something, but from someone who's actually lived it or comes from a community that lives it. And in that moment, I decided, you know, I can't do this anymore. And so I said, look, I will continue to write my column. I'll continue to do my podcast. I'll continue to do live events for Washington Post Live, but I can't sit there anymore. And I resigned. And so this is why, again, I urge people to read the entire book, because this chapter is only 11 pages of 270-something pages. And you read the pages before it in order to understand the context in which I determined that I had to resign from the Ed Board. And then in the pages after, you get to see that, you know, that moment, as tough as it was for me to live it and then to write about it, it is not the be-all and end-all of my experience in Washington. And in fact, the book ends on an incredibly hopeful note. And so, you know, it's my hope that people, when they read it, they will gain a better understanding. I'm not asking anyone to completely 100% agree with me. I mean, we can disagree on a lot of things, but, you know, I already had my book contract. I was writing the memoir when this went down. And so the idea that I'm not going to write about this thing that happened, I think is a little bananas, but not that anyone has said that I shouldn't have, but, you know, it was a big thing that happened. It's something where, you know, look, I take responsibility for doing what I did and writing what I wrote. But if anyone thought that I was not going to write about this and write about this with honesty and clarity, then I don't know, perhaps those folks are thinking I would be complicit in my own silencing. That, given the conversation we've just had, Steele, that would be insane.
Right. Right. Well, and so I can see and hear the consistency if you look back over the course of this conversation and how we started it and how we talked about, you know, the folks who were on your shoulders and on your head, right? Those three pioneers who influenced you. The one core message was be you, be authentically you. And so that makes a lot of sense when you get to that point in the book, when those events unfold in that boardroom around the development of that op-ed and how you felt your voice was used or not used as part of that. That's just Jonathan being authentically Jonathan. I mean, and anyone who knew you at that time in that room should probably have known how you would respond, right? They should have some sense of where Jonathan Capehart goes. So when you raise the concerns that you raise, it was not out of character for you.
You would think that.
You would think that. So with that in mind, before I let you jump out of here, what wisdom would you impart on your younger self starting off in journalism as a young gay Black man, given the journey that you've now covered, with more obviously lying ahead?
I think that the one thing to keep in mind is when I, at a very young age, I've known this is what I wanted to do. What was different was I had no roadmap. There were no journalists in my family. There are no writers, no authors in my family. No one in the news business, anywhere in the news business in my family. The closest that I came to any of that was my uncle McKinley Branch, who was an electrician at 30 Rock. That's the closest I came. Right. And it was him letting me into the building one day after my Carlton interview and taking me with him to the nightly news office because he had some work to do, that I had me sit on a sofa and right in front of me was a woman. I finally got the courage to ask her her name, Ann Skakel-Tarian. And she was a producer, and she asked me, what did I want to be when I grow up? I was about 16, 17 years old. Again, when someone asks you what you want, tell them. And so I told her, I said, I'm going to be a Moscow correspondent for NBC News. And then I'm trying to decide between whether I should go to the London Bureau or the White House. But if I go to the London Bureau, I definitely then want to go to the White House. And then when I come to New York and be anchor of the Today Show. And I don't know I don't remember the look on her face. But when my uncle came back and said we had to go and I thanked her, she stopped. She said, stop, wait a minute. And she pulled out an NBC notepad from her desk. She wrote down the name Kay Bradley and her phone number and with a flourish ripped it off and said, here, get yourself an internship on the Today Show. That's why I'm in the spot I'm in right now. Right. So what I would tell my younger self at that moment with all those dreams and no roadmap, I would say to the younger me, you're going to be just fine.
Going to be just fine. Just fine. And you're even going to write at Bloomberg. So there you go. Jonathan Capehart, the book Yet Here I Am, Lessons from a Black Man's Search for Home. Where is home, Jonathan? Where is that home for you?
Well, I mean, it's... the physical home is Washington.
No. That's not what your tagline is speaking to. Your tagline is not speaking to a physical home.
Yeah.
Where is that emotional, spiritual, professional, personal home for you?
That home, it's in multiple places. As I write in the book, home can be could be a person, it could be a place, it could be a thing, it could be a moment. And so for me, home is with my dear friends. Home is whenever I'm in New York City. Home is whenever I'm in Italy, no matter where I am in Italy, but particularly Rome or Naples, where, you know, I was in Rome when I wrote that chapter. Right. About why I left the Ed Board. It was important to me. I'm glad the timing worked out because I knew I needed to be in a space that was comfortable, a space that was home, that felt like a hug. And to be first in Tuscany and then in Rome for 5 days, sitting on a balcony, writing longhand, writing. See, this
y'all
chapter.
Thought I was kidding when I said villa.
No, this was a hotel in Rome. But being in that city and writing about that time gave me the emotional, not crutch, just the emotional place I needed to be to write about something so significant. And so home is multiple places.
Well, wherever home is, you bring style, you bring authenticity, and I enjoy it, and I am so glad just to be at home with you. I really, really do appreciate our friendship and getting to know you through this book. Thanks for writing it and inviting all of us to be a part of the journey of a young Black man who's finding home where he is. Jonathan Capehart, Yet Here I Am. Appreciate you, brother.
Thanks so much, Michael. Really.
Absolutely. Folks, that does it for our time together. I hope you got a little peek at my friend here. You can get an even fuller appreciation for the je ne sais quoi, the
je ne sais quoi.
The effervescence of Jonathan Capehart when you pick up a copy of Yet Here I Am. Y'all know where to get it. I would highly recommend the audio book. I would highly recommend the download version or the hard copy, which I'm still waiting for. He got signed one for me. But other than that, folks, do it. Get it. Enjoy it this summer. Continue to follow Jonathan, his writings at the Washington Post and his work at PBS. As long as we have PBS, because, well, that's a whole nother conversation. I'll get Jonathan back on for that one. Until next time, y'all, take care of yourselves. Remember what I always tell you, don't play with stupid.